Welcome. To a fine autumn evening in a warm Zen hall with companions of the way. I thought tonight I might do a little field trip report. This weekend I went to the Science and Non-Duality Conference. Has anybody heard of that?
Yeah.
Did anybody go? It's been happening for maybe 8 years or so in San Jose as an annual event, and I had never been before. But this year I ended up giving a presentation on non-duality and Zen, so I showed up. And it was an unusual and wonderful event. Sorry I missed the previous ones. And I think there maybe as it continues in future years, it's going to start moving around to different places, so it might not be in San Jose again for a while. Science and Non-Duality at the Hayes Mansion over in San Jose, which is this huge conference center that was someone's mansion at one point. So it's this beautiful grounds, big grassy field in the middle of the city, and this conference, which was over 1,000 people and over 200 presenters, which meant that in this all day for 3 days, you couldn't go to all of these presentations, obviously, right? There are many things happening in different rooms at the same time, and so you have to kind of choose between them. This is their program, SAND, Science and Non-Duality, SAND. If you're interested, you can go to their website, and they have many, many videos and articles and talks about non-duality from both spiritual, traditional perspectives and science. And it struck me that this kind of like science and non-duality thing seems to be much more popular than the Buddhism and non-duality thing. And I think it's good to stay in touch with these kind of things because there's this movement that's happening. I heard the phrase a lot, contemporary non-duality, which is spiritual teachers that are based on old Indian traditions, but kind of outside of traditions, but amazing teachers. I really feel like so much respect for many of them and how they present this understanding and practice with non-duality. And then science, in a way, I think science is people might not look at it this way, but I think sometimes we might say that science is like our like national religion. In a Christian nation, primarily, maybe in some ways science is kind of almost as popular as a kind of worldview, right? So I think it's something about our culture. We're really looking for we don't want like kind of magical mumbo jumbo. We're looking for something really direct and verifiable. And science is, these days especially, science is really looking into the nature of reality, right? Especially quantum physics, and physicists in general were most of these scientists, but also, you know, biologists and other types of scientists. So in this is just the, you know, the program of all the different events. It's over 100 pages, this book, but I thought just the first paragraph as a kind of introduction to this event. And they have a different theme every year. So this year's theme is on the edge of the unknown. Actually, it starts with a quote from Nisargadatta, I think the founding organizers for this event or students of the teachings of the Indian sage Nisargadatta Maharaj. So he says, I do not negate the world. I see it appearing in consciousness, which is the totality of the known in the immensity of the unknown. So the world that we perceive is the totality of the known appearing in the immensity of the unknown, which is like consciousness or awareness. This introduction says, both science and spirituality reflect the human urge to know, that perennial itch to make sense of who we are and of the world in which we live. This search is an essential part of being human. We live life supported by knowledge. However, the larger our island of knowledge, the larger the shore of the unknown becomes. That's a nice image, huh? Our island of knowledge is expanding more and more, but then the shoreline of this island, the shoreline of the unknown becomes bigger and bigger as we know more. And I think that's what scientists are saying too these days. The more we discover, the less we know. So, some of the highlight reports that I really appreciated of the many teachers at this conference was in the Buddhist department. I think was a little bit underrepresented personally, because I think particularly Mahayana Buddhism is all about non-duality, and Zen is definitely about non-duality in its heart. So I was glad to be able to bring up some traditional Zen teachings to this group. But one of the larger events was Robert Thurman. You may know his Tibetan Buddhist scholar, a very lively speaker. And he gave a nice talk on Buddha as a scientist. That Buddha, and I think that's why a lot of us are drawn to Buddhism, is it has a very rational, almost scientific flavor of let's try to examine closely what's happening in our own experience and see what we can find in a kind of scientific way. So one of the points he made I thought was interesting. If we look at greed, hate, and delusion, right, is what we're constantly confessing and letting go of in our practice. That's the source of suffering, greed, hate, and delusion. But I think he's pretty politically involved, Robert Thurman. And so he said on the scale of society, on a kind of larger scale of society, we could look at these three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion, as like really kind of taking over in the world these days. Greed as consumerism, hate as militarism, and delusion as individualism. And I think he even brought up and depression, widespread depression based on kind of like a feeling of separation. So these, you know, huge problems in our society are just, you know, large scale versions of greed, hate, and delusion. So of course our practice is addressing these larger issues at the root. Robert Thurman also said, we might hear this in different ways, but this one struck me. He said, in Buddhism, the highest goal is learning. We might put it different ways at different times, but maybe he was trying to bridge this gap of science and Buddhism, and especially maybe in the old Indian Buddhism with these huge universities, this love of knowledge and learning, especially experiential learning, how the mind works, what the world is, and how we can find peace is a learning project. In Zen, in some ways, maybe we downplay the learning a little bit more because it's such a direct school of Buddhism. We say, just sit. And but in a way, that's a kind of learning too. We learn a lot when just sitting. So I ran into various friends there. Anthony Aguirre, Sally's husband, was an astrophysicist at the university, and he gave a talk on how we know things or not know things in the universe. It seemed like there's a wide range of scientists and even physicists, but it seems like the ones who show up at a conference like this pretty much like have to be on board, it seems like, with this view that we can't really verify that there is any universe apart from the awareness of it. And that's what non-duality is about. So if there's still some kind of old school scientists that say, you know, there really is a physical material world, and if there's no sentient beings, it's still there. I think that those scientists weren't around this conference. But in fact, science these days is kind of what they're finding more and more. Non-duality, I think, is a wonderful term. Not two. It's a little bit different than saying oneness. A little bit different. It's just saying we can't find a separation. And particularly, just to clarify, it seemed like there's universal agreement when we're talking about non-duality and spirituality and science in these terms. We're talking about the non-duality of mind and object. Or, mind and the world, or subject and object, or grasper and grasped. Sometimes in Zen we might talk about, the non-duality between right and wrong, this kind of thing. But I think that's kind of missing the point, really, of what spiritual non-duality is really about, a kind of misperception of externality and separation. So we have to examine our experience. Is a little quote I wrote down from Deepak Chopra, who was fun to watch our friend Sangha member here, Anthony, be kind of grilled by Deepak Chopra on this panel. Now, Anthony, you wouldn't say that there is some kind of a universe outside of awareness, would you? He didn't really say yes or no, but these things are complex. Another teacher that I hadn't met before, but I really appreciate, is Francis Lucille. Anyone heard of him? French man. It's coming. Most of the non-dual spirituality is coming more from the Advaita Vedanta Indian tradition. Very similar to Mahayana Buddhism, particularly mind-only Buddhism, and Buddha nature teachings are very similar. And I think in India, these traditions historically influenced each other a lot. Like, this tradition came after these Mahayana Buddhist teachings. It was a sort of a, we might call Hindu way of rephrasing them. So, although almost none of these people teach in the old Indian style, as they're trying to present it freshly, it's based on these non-dual teachings. So Francis Lucille, he said that non-duality, spiritual practice of non-duality, is like science in that it throws out anything that is not 100% provable or verifiable in our direct experience. And science should be like that too, right? We can make guesses about how things might be, and nice theories, and even maybe there's this maybe gray area in science of mathematical formulas that seem, the formulas are very verifiable, but, and they're kind of proving things like black holes or something. But in a way, non-duality is even more scientific in a way, because it's, it doesn't rely on theories. We maybe do approach it through hearing teachings. I think we have to, because it's quite subtle. But it is directly verifiable in our experience. We might even say it's the only thing that's completely verifiable. And that's, Francis Lucille made this point. He said, really the only thing that we can be 100% sure about is that awareness is present. Pretty much anything else is, we might be pretty sure, like for example, that the world is really here, or we might say that we're not dreaming right now. We might say, oh no, I know I'm not dreaming, I'm kidding, you know, I'm not waking up. But we, you know, maybe we've been in dreams before where we're doing this, and then we're pretty convinced that it's real, and then we do wake up, right? So we might be 95% convinced that we're not dreaming right now, but actually I think scientifically, I don't think we can prove 100% that we're not, right? But the fact that awareness is aware of what's happening, that we can be 100% sure, even if we're dreaming, right? If we're dreaming, awareness is aware of the dream. If we're awake, awareness is aware of awake. So I thought, that's nice. It's the one thing that's, as long as there's an experience happening, this is always the case, that there's an awareness of it. Otherwise, there's no experience. We can't verify anything of outside of experience, right? So, a maybe simple sort of obvious point, but I thought, in a way, it's a little bit of a meditation instruction, I think, too, to contemplate how the only thing we can be 100% sure of is that we're aware. Another teacher who is actually the student of Francis Lucille, and a teacher that I've really been resonating with for the past few years, Rupert Spira. I just feel like I think different people resonate with different styles of teaching, and for some reason, the way he articulates non-duality with the kind of this economy of every word being chosen very carefully to express this reality of non-duality and all-inclusive awareness is just so clear. But it was interesting because I feel like it can't be clearer than this. It's like this is like Zen teaching with like no frills for me, I feel like. And there was one talk where I went to several of his, and this kind of guided meditations also, and one where I felt like it was just so lucidly, like, perfectly clear. And then, you know, it's question and answer, and somebody said, I don't mean this to be you know, insulting in any way, but actually I didn't understand a word that you said. And that in itself was a good teaching for me, because I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Something could be so clearer than anything could ever be. Maybe it's sort of developing a kind of language. Or somebody else who is somewhat in this world, maybe, I don't know his background, but he said, I feel like I'm not actually a stupid person. I'm like, you know, kind of understand a lot of things, but this, what you're saying is like, I cannot follow. So that itself was a good teaching for me. And in fact, this is a nice teaching too, I thought. The person said, well, how do you know that actually that everything you're saying, nobody's getting it? And do you ever have the thought, like, maybe nobody's getting it? And Rupert said, no, I don't. Actually, I know the people are. And I thought, ooh, that's interesting. Is he reading minds? And he said it as, well, it's just like when you're having a conversation with one person, And you can kind of tell if the person's with you or not, right? They might not understand everything that you're saying, but their eyes are not glazing over, right? And you're not losing them. And he said, so it's a sort of maybe body language and energetic thing in some ways. They might not get everything, but they're connecting with something true, hopefully, in what's being said. And he said, I can look at a smaller room of people. I can see, you know, most people are kind of on board, but in a bigger group, it's too many people to tell. You can't track them all. So I'm losing some, and I don't know that. And so I'm sorry if I lost you, he said to the person. So there's maybe something about like where the teaching maybe comes through a kind of just resonance sometimes, even if we don't get all of it. I appreciated that. And Rupert said he was at one retreat where people wanted to cancel some of the meditation to watch the presidential debate recently. And he was willing to do that. He thought, and this is our important time, is how this goes, right? And it's a kind of critical time in our country in many ways. And he said, while he was watching the debate, he said he felt quite strongly that that Donald and Hillary are actually in love with each other. And just like you, the room all burst into laughter. And Rupert's this very, very even, quite serious guy. And he said, that wasn't a joke. It wasn't meant to be a joke. He said, really, like, their conceptual thought makes, which the debate is highly about conceptual thought, right? And in the midst of this conceptual thought, they're really kind of against each other in these certain ways. But between each of their thoughts, it's pure love. And the same is true of us, right? I thought that's a nice teaching. Conceptual thought is what creates the illusion of separation and duality. So between two conceptual thoughts, which is happening, you know, right now, between our thoughts are very fast when we're, you know, thinking and talking. But even so, between them, that space of non-conceptual construction is where there's no separation. That is non-duality, and love is another name for non-duality. True love, where it means like there's no separation, literally. And it's like reality, too, that there really is nothing but love. Not like love for another. Love for, I love somebody, that's not really the true love of non-duality. This kind of love is the love that's always the case, whether we know it or not. It is total unity. So that really ran true for me. He said, if they could see that for just a moment, if they stopped talking in the debate, they'd see how much they love each other. Not even each other as separate, but they are in love. And he said, it's nice in the form of the debate that at the beginning and end of the debate, they shake hands, right? Which is such a beautiful gesture. It's just a gesture, but it's a nice gesture to represent we're actually connected. So before the debate, we're respectfully join each other, and then we have at it, right, in the debate, and then at the end, we shake hands again. So I thought that is beautiful that our country has that form for debates. Maybe they're not exactly realizing total non-duality in the handshake. But if they were not to be thinking about what's going to happen before or after, maybe they would. One thing I felt at this conference is, I mean, it's very, very heady, right? Talk after talk all day long. And I mean, I love that kind of stuff, but even I was getting exhausted by the end, retaining all of this. And not so much practice, right? I felt like it was a symposium kind of conference, and there were meditation sessions at the begin every day. But Even sometimes when people, I could tell some people new to spiritual practice were asking, this is amazing, and I'm opening to this non-duality thing, but how can I, you know, practice it in my actual life? And I felt like the answers all sort of came kind of abstract again. And from a kind of non-dual perspective, there's like not really like something to do, right? And I thought, that's the beauty of what we have, right? We do have to talk about and understand these things more and more, learn forever. But then we have this practice of sitting in silence. So, such a gift. A few people after I talked about Zen, they're like, this is great. How can I, do you have a place to come practice? I'm like, yeah. We'll see if any of them show up. Some say, I'll be there. I felt more and more as it went on, like, there's not that much talk about how we're actually living in the world as the out of this flowering understanding of non-duality, which is in fact the point, really, I would say, is how we're living with each other and in this world of suffering. So maybe because of this, when I got a chance to ask Rupert Spira after one of the talks a question, I thought, what do I really want to, what is something that he almost never talks about himself, actually, that I really want to hear his take on it. So I said, I asked, when, in other words, at the time, one is in accord with this reality of non-duality, and there is nothing other than this all-inclusive awareness, and one's, you know, on board with that, because you can realize it, but then not most of the time we're not kind of with it, right? But at this moment of accord with this reality, is it possible to harm any type of sentient being in any possible way, even like swatting a mosquito? Like, I kind of really wanted to know that. Or what, I kind of do know the answer, actually. I'm quite confident about it. But I wanted to hear what he would say, and he came up very close and he said, that's right, it's almost impossible. And there were more people around, so I didn't get to follow up. Almost. Like, what kind of exceptions might there be? Which I thought it was nice because it left me with a sort of a koan. Yes, I said, don't be too hard on yourself about this. And I think hard on oneself is when we're out of the view and then we're trying to not harm. But I do have the confidence that the moments that we are really are in complete trust that the other life is our life, it's like literally impossible to intentionally harm another. It would be like, you know, if we're loving our body, it would be just like for fun, just like slicing off our hand or something. It's like, I mean, impossible meaning like it would be just ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. So that is the little sort of like ethical piece in there that doesn't often get mentioned in these non-duality discussions. Although I think it naturally, one's life is naturally expressed in a more and more harmful and more loving and compassionate way, the more and more we can open to this reality. So maybe that's why it's not emphasized. And I think traditional Zen is kind of like that too. It's so emphasizing the ultimate non-duality that there's not that much talk about the conventional, you know, day-to-day how you do things. Earlier Buddhism, there's a lot more of that. But Zen is more of as a non-dual tradition. There's less, but I think it's nice that if we haven't completely opened to the non-duality, we start acting as if we're not separate, even in a like effortful kind of like somewhat maybe contrived way, then we're actually becoming more and more in accord with that reality. And then maybe at some point we flip into that new view, and it's like we're already kind of like, oh, it's not so shocking then maybe to keep not harming. Whereas if we're really have a kind of messy, harmful sort of life, then if we happen to, it might be hard then to flip into that view, but if we did, it might be just like, wow, now everything has to change. And that would be shocking. Yes?
Similar question to what you asked, Rupert. If we were really in accord with non-duality, what would our relationship to fear be like?
Fear. Yeah, I think at the time of being in accord with it, I would say again, impossible to have any fear, right? And right, because fear is always based on something external, on a separation. If we are everything, there is nothing, you know, to harm us, actually. It's all the whole works together. Yeah, so many great things about non-duality. And you know, I think that we're often, even if we can confirm this view, which is quite subtle, right, and it takes some work, I feel like for myself, this is many, many years of pretty intensive Zen practice going down slightly different avenues, actually, that before kind of like, even though I heard these teachings so many times, it was like, yeah, non-duality. Like it didn't really like, I'm working on this other stuff, you know, that I can understand more maybe, and still I feel like this strong trust, but my actual day-to-day experience, like habitual patterns, pull me into this illusory view, and kind of like knowing it's illusory view sometimes, but most of the time feeling, you know, there's some sense of a world out there that could harm me. So just a few things from the talk that I gave about Zen and non-duality. I tried to present a little sort of historical progression of this. Wasn't just invented by Zen. This is the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra we studied here has maybe the first time this was said in the Buddha tradition of Buddha Dharma so directly, that the Buddha says, I have explained that consciousness is fully distinguished by the fact that its object of observation is consciousness only. I think that was probably the first time that this was really explicitly said. It's not really there in earlier Buddhism. The object of observation is actually consciousness too. And Maitreya Bodhisattva asks the Buddha, what is the one-pointed mind? And the Buddha said, it's the realization that the image that's the focus of concentration in meditation, that the image is actually made of consciousness. Having realized that, it is then just attending to suchness, which is another name for non-duality. And then later, in Chinese Chan Zen tradition, Baijiang, who was the one who was friends with foxes, Baijiang said, just understand that the many things do not originate from themselves. All of them come into being from one's own single mind's impulse of imagination mistakenly grasping appearances. All the appearances that are happening come into being from one's own mental impulse of imagination that grasps appearances. If you know that mind and objects fundamentally do not contact each other, you're set free on the spot. It's a little bit unusual. I haven't heard it put quite that way before, but I like that one. Realize that mind and objects don't contact each other, which actually contradicts early Buddhism. Because there they say, like, the eye and the color, contact. Sparsha means contact. So this is like overturning this earlier thing to see that they don't contact each other. And why don't they meet or contact? Because, two things that can contact each other, but if its consciousness is, the object is made of consciousness and the subject is made of consciousness, it's appearing like contact, but it's not really contact or meeting, right? Nothing ever meets. So that's, again, we could say, in true love, no one ever meets another. Right? A little bit, one step down is like, we really meet fully and we love each other. But that's a little bit dualistic love, where there's meeting. If you know that mind and objects fundamentally or originally don't ever meet or contact each other, you'll be set free on the spot. Each of the many things is in a state of quiescence right where it is. This very place is the site of awakening. So that's Baijiang's non-duality teaching. His student, Huang Bo, said, all Buddhas and all living beings are only one mind. There is no other reality. This mind, big mind, from beginninglessness has never been born and never passed away. It has no shape and no form. It doesn't exist or not exist. It goes beyond all measurements, labels, and oppositions. This very being is it. So we might say, now we're talking about something really abstract and somewhere invisible, but this very being is it. All of this is it. This very being is it. When you stir thoughts, you turn away from it. And similarly, the relationship now of between awareness and the world is expressed in many great Zen teachings, like the entire world of the 10 directions, which is all directions throughout space, right? The entire universe in the 10 directions is the whole body of a practitioner, or like our true body, right? From this non-duality point of view of awareness. The entire universe in the 10 directions is the radiant light of the self. In the entire world of the 10 directions, there's not a single person that is not oneself. And then Yunmen, the great teacher, Yunmen in China. I also often thought this was a kind of like strange koan story, but from this point of view, the way we've been talking now, this maybe can be kind of clear. Yunmen says, everyone has a light. When you look for it, you don't see it, and it's dark and obscure. We're talking about our awareness. We can't get a hold of it. We can't find it, right? Everyone has this light, beginninglessly and endlessly. Right? But when you look for it, you can't find it. It's obscure and dark if you try to look at it. "What is everyone's light?" He asked the audience, and the audience couldn't respond, so Yunmen said for them, "The kitchen pantry and the main gate." The kitchen pantry and the main gate. It's a beautiful statement of non-duality, yeah? We're trying to look back for this light that's somehow as the source, but actually, all of this is it. Right? And a nice little meditation I like to do to try to approach this, because hopefully this isn't like a theoretical idea that we should take on faith. This is something we should be able to confirm 100% in our own experience. And I think a nice way to approach it is similar to Baijiang's teaching. Try to look for the place where awareness meets the kitchen pantry, or the book, or the altar, or the hand. Look for the place where they really examine very closely in direct experience. Where do they meet?
Meet.
Meet, yeah. Where does awareness meet the object?
What do we just decide?
What do you say?
What we just decided that there is no meeting.
Well, can you confirm in your own experience 100% that awareness does not meet this hand? I think it's just a slightly different way of looking, but I think we can come to see that basically it's more that we just can't find a meeting place. Well, there must be a meeting place, right? Awareness must meet the hand. Well, if so, where? This is a meditation. This is not like a question to try to answer rationally. It's a meditation practice, right? Really look, and not just for 5 seconds. Spend 40 minutes looking. We're looking at the wall, right? Where does awareness meet the wall? Keep asking, right? So the answer is quite wonderful. Right? Dogen. Well, maybe I'll just. It's getting late. So let me just. I'll skip Dogen. We get enough Dogen. I mean, it's endless, these teachings of non-duality, right? But I thought this was a nice one from Guishan. I ran out of time at the conference, of course, too. But I thought, on the theme of not knowing, this I thought was a really good one, because and you might feel now, too, like, these sound like really weird teachings, and I'm like that guy with Rupert Spira who said, like, I don't understand a word you're talking about. In case you're that person, this teaching is for you. A monk asked Guishan, "What is the way?" Which is like, what is enlightenment, or, you know, reality? Guishan said, "No mind is the way." The monk said, "I don't understand." Guishan said, "Just understand that which doesn't understand." We might even say, really, like, look for actually this mind that doesn't understand. The monk asked, "What is that which doesn't understand?" Guishan said, "Just you are it. It's not someone else. People just need to directly realize that which doesn't understand. This is indeed the true mind." Or we might say, no mind. "This is indeed Buddha. If you externally get a piece of knowledge or understanding and consider that the path of Zen, you're out of touch." Yes?
I want to go back to asking Rupert about being in the core, being capable of harming, and him saying almost.
Yeah. That's a great koan. Yeah. That's a great one.
That's sort of real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's leave that as a koan, yeah. Yeah. What does harm actually mean? And we might even see it both ways. Was that based on a duality? I think most animals are function also in dualistic consciousness, just like humans. So we might say, maybe that would sound weird to say, if the lion was in touch for one moment with the infinite love that is non-duality, would they then be capable of violently attacking the antelope? Maybe. I mean, I wouldn't want to say.
It's sort of a play with this human animal, where if that happened, then the world would disappear. The lion would, and so would everything else. So,
in a way, that is, in that moment of non-duality, actually the world does disappear. Yeah. There isn't a world. Yes, Helen.
Well, I have a lot of reactions, and but I'm only going to do this. So, the non-duality, if I could use words infinite or ultimate, whatever we use.
Yeah.
I think that's what all spiritual traditions and religions
yes.
are about.
I agree.
And science is just a different sphere. It really has nothing to do with the other.
I would say science is usually not considered spiritual, but in fact, I think it's starting to, despite itself, discover the same things. I think the motivation is different. Maybe if we say that Buddhism is really about learning and knowledge, then we might say they're very similar. But if Buddhism is really about relieving suffering for ourselves and all beings, then we might say science is, you know, at least quantum physics isn't explicitly about that goal. But in fact, I think some quantum physicists, as they start to discover these things, feel like it's a kind of spiritual experience. And I think it might affect their lives in a spiritual way, and even their relationships with other people. It might. And some others might be like, no, this is the realm of science. Don't let it go outside of that.
I think that in studying science, we come up against mystery.
Uh-huh, yeah. And coming up against mystery is itself a spiritual experience, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not the work or the, it's not the focus of science itself.
Yeah.
But the other thing about the ultimate, seeking in any religion, I'd say that also that love, feeling love, living in love, and calm without fear is also then the byproduct of that, seeking the ultimate or trying to connect with the ultimate, the infinite, which,
Yeah, love, I think that's how in our kind of secularized society, I think that's one of the main ways that a secular culture can get in touch with spirituality is being in love. I think it is a kind of, at its core is a kind of non-duality, and it goes along with this great joy too, right? Which fits in with the spiritual traditions. It's just that it's hard to sustain that. It's often felt like, early in a relationship, and then conceptual thinking starts, adding in. And of course we try to tap back into it, but I think that's one of the normal everyday ways that people can open to the mystery. Yeah. Yes, Patrick.
Well, I can remember the very first time I came here and sat a 40-minute meditation for the first time. And then listen to Catherine give a talk. Well, I don't even know what the talk was about, but mainly because I didn't understand anything she said. And then the next week was Tygen Blayton talking about his brand new book of silent illumination, so another whole, you know, hour of not really understanding. But I think somehow I really did understand that they were talking about important or the great matter, which is maybe why I came in the room in the first place. And it also was very connected to my own sitting, those, you know, two periods of zazen. You know, whatever they were saying had something to do with, you know, the calm that I experienced, you know, in this different way. You know, even the tension in my knees or my shoulders from trying to sit just right. So even though there wasn't any cognitive understanding, there was this real connection between what they were saying and what I was experiencing in my body and mind. And it just made me, you know, kind of lean forward and be interested in the whole process. And so that's, I remember that.
Yeah. Or
trying to engage with the mind that doesn't understand.
Yeah, me too. Often for me it was like, those were the, my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, I would say from the early teachings that I received from him, I didn't understand the thing he was saying. But in fact, that's what kept me coming back. That's what I thought. The ones that I understood really clearly, I'm like, yeah, I got that part. But this one, why is he saying that? Like, I gotta go back. So, yeah. And I think, and there's this way in which something seeps in, like when we're chanting and certain lines jump out at us and we might say, well, why that line? We can't say maybe, but it touches us somehow. Yeah. Yeah, another thing Rupert Spira said, he's got a teenage son who was there on one of the retreats where he was traveling, and his son has never asked him about this non-duality stuff at all. It's just completely not interested and never asked. And Rupert says, I'm not planning to ever say anything to him about it. If he comes through on his own, that's beautiful. I have a lot to say. But he has to come to it on his own. And but in the one time he asked, do you mind if I just come into one of your talks sometime? And of course he was like, sure. If you want, you know. And so he did come in, and he saw his son in the back, listen for a little while, then leave. And then later, and then he didn't bring it up, he said, at dinner. Just if he wants to bring it up, he can. But at some point his son did say, you know that talk, I came in and I didn't understand a word you were saying, but I loved the way that you were giving the talk. It was beautiful just to see your expression. I really felt your sincerity and wholeheartedness. And Rupert said, that was so beautiful, better than understanding. Didn't need to get the words. So, time to close, but I just want to mention one last thing, because next week is Sejiki ceremony, feeding the hungry ghosts. Yeah, so instead of a Dharma talk, please come if you can. It's a unique thing that we kind of connected to Halloween, right? And it's this, you know, Zen ceremony where we try to speak to hungry ghosts in the language of mantra, and we make offerings and we put our intention forward. But in the light of this talk, I would say, a ghost is when a ghost is created when we can't fully receive our experience that's happening, and it's based on belief in duality, right? Because the non-dual awareness itself is completely receptive. It can't say no. In fact, if we're having an experience, in a way, awareness is saying yes, has said yes to the experience. It's why it can happen. But we, like small mind, can say no and like, I resist what's happening. Even just a little bit, like unconsciously, we're sort of half-heartedly doing something is a little bit like not fully receiving it, right? And we could say that creates a ghost, this lingering residue from a non-fully combusted experience. And so that's one way to look at ghosts. Yeah, kind of an obscuration, a lingering, invisible, but somewhat bothersome, spirit in the background. So in the ceremony, we feed them these uncompletely received experiences. We nourish them, we love them. We say, like, all of you that we've kind of kept a little, like, outside of ourselves, Now we just invite you completely, and we just totally lavish you with food and drink and mantra and everything that you want. In other words, we completely embrace you, and you are us. You ghosts are us. So that's this one way to look at the spirit of this Siddiki ceremony. We feed them, but really it means like we invite them to be us. We dedicate the wholesome intentions of our open mind to the one reality here now. May it percolate in to the mind stream of every sentient being. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to rend them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.